The reading tonight is from the 38th chapter of Jeremiah. Shephatiah, son of Mattan, Gedaliah, son of Pashur, Jehukal, son of Shelemiah, and Pashur, son of Malkijah, heard what Jeremiah was telling the people, namely, "This is God's message. Whoever stays in this town will die, will be killed or starved to death or get sick and die. But those who go over to the Babylonians will save their necks and live. In God's sure word, this city is destined to fall to the army of the king of Babylon. He's going to take it over. His officials told the king, 'Please kill this man. He's got to go. He's ruining the resolve of the soldiers who are still left in the city, as well as the people themselves, by spreading these words. This man isn't looking after the good of this people. He's trying to ruin us.' King Zedekiah caved in. 'If you say so, go ahead. Handle it your way. You're too much for me.' So they took Jeremiah and threw him into the cistern of Malkijah, the king's son, that was in the courtyard of the palace guard. They lowered him down with ropes. There wasn't any water in the cistern, only mud. Jeremiah sank into the mud." We're on the final week of our meditations with Heidi Haverkamp, the author of Holy Solitude. We've looked at solitude and silence, solitude and struggle, solitude and journey. Last week, solitude and hospitality. And this week is solitude and confinement. Solitude and confinement. Forced solitude. Even imprisonment. Many deeply faithful people before us have been forced into solitude. Joseph thrown down into the pit by his brothers. Daniel in the lion's den. Peter jailed in Jerusalem. Martin Luther hiding in Wartburg Castle. Dietrich Bonhoeffer in a Nazi prison in Berlin. Martin Luther King Jr. writing his famous letters from a Birmingham jail. Confinement can be manifest in a physical cell, a physical or a mental illness, or any confining circumstances that are beyond our control. It can be both physical and spiritual. It's a time when we lose the most basic means of being human, a connection to the natural world, the ability to make a choice, physical fellowship and chances to learn and change. Even when we have been faithful, God-loving and God-living people, we can still find ourselves confined. Many in our congregation, many of us, have encountered periods of confinement. These can be a time of despair, a time when we lose hope, a time when we cry out to God, and especially a time when we long for freedom. Sometimes freedom comes in this life. Daniel, Joseph, Martin Luther. Sometimes that freedom comes in the next, Dietrich Bonhoeffer or Martin Luther King Jr. When we are confined, we need others to reach in, touch us and support us and love us and tell us that God is with us. When we see others in confinement, we need to be the ones to reach in with the hands and the heart of God. We also need to remember that we are never trapped in solitude that is beyond God's reach. Never. I want to read you a short story tonight. It's called The Cab Ride I Will Never Forget, and it's written by Kent Nerburn. There was a time in my life 20 years ago when I was driving a cab for a living. It was a cowboy's life, a gambler's life, a life for someone who wanted no boss, constant movement, and the thrill of a dice roll every time a new passenger got into the cab. What I didn't count on when I took the job was that it was also a ministry. Because I drove the night shift, my cab became a rolling confessional. Passengers would climb in, sit behind me in total anonymity, and tell me of their lives. We were like strangers on a train, the passengers and I, hurtling through the night, revealing intimacies we would never have dreamed of sharing during the brighter light of day. I encountered people whose lives amazed me, ennobled me, made me laugh, and made me weep. And none of those lives touched me more than that of a woman I picked up late on a warm August night. I was responding to a call from a small brick fourplex in a quiet part of town. I assumed I was being sent to pick up some partiers, or someone who had just had a fight with a lover, or someone going off to an early shift at some factory in the industrial part of town. When I arrived at the address, the building was dark, except for a single light in the ground floor window. Under these circumstances, many drivers would just honk once or twice, wait a short minute, and then drive away. Too many bad possibilities awaited a driver who went up to a darkened building at 2:30 in the morning. But I had seen too many people trapped in a life of poverty who depended on the cab as their only means of transportation. Unless a situation had a real whiff of danger, I always went to the door to find the passenger. It might, I reasoned, be someone who needs my assistance. Would I not want a driver to do the same if my mother and father had called for a cab? So I walked to the door, and I knocked. "Just a minute," answered a frail and elderly voice. I could hear the sound of something being dragged across the floor. After a long pause, the door opened. A small woman, somewhere in her 80s, stood before me. She was wearing a print dress and a pillbox hat with a veil pinned on it, like you might see in a costume shop or a Goodwill store or a 1940s movie. By her side was a small nylon suitcase. The sound had been her dragging it across the floor. The apartment looked as if no one had lived in it for years. All the furniture was covered with sheets. There were no clocks on the walls, no knickknacks, no utensils on the counters. In a corner was a cardboard box filled with photos and glassware. "Would you carry my bag out to the car?" she said. "I'd like a few minutes alone. Then if you could come back and help me, I'm not very strong." I took the suitcase to the cab, then returned to assist the woman. She took my arm, and we walked slowly to the curb. She kept thanking me for my kindness. "It's nothing," I told her. "I just try to treat my passengers the way I would want my mother treated." "Oh, you're such a good boy," she said. Her praise and appreciation were almost embarrassing. When we got in the cab, she gave me an address and then asked, "Could you drive through downtown?" "It's not the shortest way," I answered. "Oh, I don't mind," she said. "I'm in no hurry." I'm on my way to a hospice. I looked in the rearview mirror and her eyes were glistening. I don't have any family left, she continued. The doctor says I should go there. He says I don't have very long. I quietly reached over and shut off the meter. What route would you like me to go? I asked. For the next 2 hours, we drove through the city. She showed me the building where she had once worked as an elevator operator. We drove through the neighborhood where she and her husband had lived when they had first been married. She had me pull up in front of a furniture warehouse that had once been a ballroom where she had gone dancing as a girl. Sometimes she would have me slow in front of a particular building or corner and would sit staring into the darkness, saying nothing. As the first hint of sun was creasing the horizon, she suddenly said, I'm tired. Let's go now. We drove in silence to the address she had given me. It was a low building, like a small convalescent home, with a driveway that passed under a portico. Two orderlies came out to the cab as soon as we pulled up. Without waiting for me, they opened the door and began assisting the woman. They were intent, watching her every move. They must have been expecting her. Perhaps she'd phoned them right before she left. I opened the trunk and took the small suitcase up to the door. The woman was already seated in a wheelchair. How much do I owe you? She said, reaching into her purse. Nothing, I said. You have to make a living, she answered. There's other passengers, I responded. Almost without thinking, I bent and gave her a hug. She held on to me tightly. You gave an old woman a little moment of joy, she said. Thank you. There was nothing more to say. I squeezed her hand once, then walked out into the dim morning light. Behind me, I could hear the door shut. It was the sound of the closing of a life. I didn't pick up any more passengers that shift. I drove aimlessly, lost in thought. For the remainder of that day, I could hardly talk. What if that woman had gotten an angry driver, or one who was impatient to end his shift? What if I had refused to take the run, or honked once and then driven away? What if I'd been in a foul mood and had refused to engage the woman in conversation? How many other moments like that had I missed or failed to grasp? We're so conditioned to think that our lives revolve around great moments. But great moments often catch us unawares. When that woman hugged me and said that I had brought her a moment of joy, it was possible to believe that I had been placed on this earth for the sole purpose of providing her with that last ride. I do not think that I have ever done anything in my life that was any more important. May we somehow do the same.